This is the Applying Sports Science Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Greenwood, and it's great to have you here as part of the podcast family. Presented by the Human Performance Centre as part of the College of Health Sciences at the University of Memphis, we're here to talk about all things sport, science, and the real things that contribute to athlete success. And if you want the cheat notes, it's about more than just the science. In episode 6, we talk to Blake Whitcomb. Blake's a Senior Sports Science Business Development Manager at sports tech company iMeasureU. Blake has a background as a collegiate athlete in lacrosse and football and was also a strength coach prior to his move to the sales side of the industry. Blake provides some awesome insight based on his own experiences with coaches and athletes, but also his experiences trying to fill the gaps for a variety of clients. His perspective also highlights the breadth of sports science, helping us think of all the possible roles beyond the field of play. As always, we'll delve into his thoughts and opinions and lessons learned about applying sports science to help us all be better at what we do and ensure we make a real difference to athletic performance. Here we go. G'day Blake, how you doing, buddy?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, really well. Really happy to have you here on the Applying Sports Science podcast because unlike a lot of our other guests, you've got a really unique way to look at sport, sports science, and I guess technology as well. I guess I want to start with a really general question, which is what's the best lesson that you've learned about implementing tech in sports?
Yeah, good question. I think the lessons that I've learned through this role and then in some of my previous roles in strength and conditioning is there's limited budget, limited resources at every organization to a certain extent. And what often happens is technology is brought in. Sometimes it's internally validated, internally tested. Sometimes it's left over from a previous group that was there before you. And what tends to happen, I think, is a piece of technology can provide good information, good measurement, for specific things, but it often gets used for everything, right? So if let's say, for example, I have good skill sets with force plate analysis, maybe I like to do some sort of bilateral force plate testing, looking at asymmetries, or I like to do jump monitoring, then all of a sudden it's, well, what else can that be applied to? And it starts to get extrapolated into areas that maybe aren't even needed to be monitored or aren't something that you'd consider to be a primary key performance indicator. And so I think it's kind of attaching the technology to every question is what happens.
So almost that classic thing of I'm good at this. Let me show how much I can use it for rather than the deeper you go into your tech, the further you get away from the question that was asked in the first place.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily know that it's individuals always wanting to show how good they are with the piece of tech. I think sometimes it's let's get as much ROI as we can out of this technology because we spent X amount of money on it. Sometimes
if I just use this just for jump testing, then I'd feel like I'm wasting $30,000 here or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that can be kind of a trap that sometimes technology falls into. And you kind of have to always go back to what problem is this solving for me and the organization? And, yes, how can I implement it often, but is it necessary at this point? And is it providing value at this point is kind of the question.
It is such a fine balance, right? Of that, exactly as you alluded to, you've spent money on this. You know it's got good stuff, but it's not appropriate right now. So are you almost brave enough to say, yes, we have this thing, but we don't need it right now because that doesn't matter? And I think it does take a level of professional bravery. Do you think that's a fair word, almost to just shelve it for a bit?
Yeah, and I think it's almost the deeper you understand the technology, the more freely you're probably able to have that conversation. Right, because you can really highly explain to the end user of the outcomes, which maybe is the coach or the strength staff, where which basket you want to put all your eggs into for that piece of technology and why. And then maybe for the other options, you know, that's not the route to go.
So you alluded to that background as a strength coach, and would I call you a five-star elite recruit in your footballing days?
No, definitely not. I played football and lacrosse growing up. I was kind of one of those overachievers, undersized for the positions that I played, but I understood the game really well. So had some opportunities to play in college and ended up playing both sports in college. And then once I got out of my undergraduate, just really found that I loved coaching in general, sport coaching as well as strength and conditioning, and went down that path and went down the kind of classic graduate school, master's in kinesiology, internships left and right, graduate assistantships, and kind of, you know, worked that typical ladder up in strength and conditioning.
When you think about that, I mean, you spoke about ladder, you spoke about lots of, I guess, lots of sort of roles or steps on that ladder. Would you recommend, is that the right path that sort of the junior sports scientists of the world should consider, or the junior strength coaches of the world should consider? Is there a better way to do that, or you just have to just get stuck in and sort of almost be your best at every step?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a more optimal way to do it than maybe how I did it. But I think the number one underlying thing is the coaching experience. So if you're wanting to be a strength and conditioning coach, you need to go somewhere that's going to facilitate your ability to practice with athletes, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of internships that you'll go through where they might not let you coach, you know, or there's a curriculum that you're studying, but you don't get to implement it. And I was fortunate in that I got to implement coaching really early on. So you coach for thousands of hours and you realize you're not that good. And there's a lot of skill and time and mentorship that can be taken advantage of along that route. So I think the thing that I would change is I would probably seek more mentorships. So I had good kind of managerial relationships with the head strength coaches, the assistant strength coaches at internships and graduate assistantships. But I think a lot more coaches are willing to engage with younger strength coaches if they're willing to put in the effort to seek them out. And I wasn't great at that as kind of a young guy. I just wasn't great at reaching out to people and trying to provide them value so that then they can impart some of their mentorship with me.
Yeah, so I remember young Daniel. I would have – I don't know if I was naive to it or just felt that I was so far below their level that there was no way I could possibly dare – you know, email somebody or call someone. And like, it was just, it didn't even, I don't think it even crossed my mind, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think it's a little different for kind of the sports science route where I've seen young sports scientists be really successful is through a really diverse skill set. So instead of, you know, this is just my personal opinion, but instead of kind of focusing on a narrow skill set within the field, having an extremely broad skill set now all of a sudden gives you utility across mm-hmm. tons of organizations, right? So maybe you're a physical therapist that has sports science interests, or maybe you're a sports scientist that's going through PT school. It's a combination, right, that now all of a sudden I have more value to an organization, which they might take a chance on me more frequently because, you know, we're in a world now where the numbers that can be around athletes are decreasing in a COVID time. So the more value I can bring as an individual, the more likely I am to be in that group that's around the athletes.
I know across my career, I've been involved in different arguments around that sort of generalist versus specialist role. And exactly as you said, like there's utility in both. There's a reason that both are good. I know when I was younger, like just a simple thing, like as a biomechanist, learning to do skin folds just meant that I could then take the skin folds for our track and field team and just gave me that little bit more value, so they didn't have to get another person to do that. And so those extra general skills don't necessarily have to be high level to provide value at, especially a team sport or a college level where either they can't afford it, they don't know how to do it, and you don't have to be an expert, you just have to know your limitation in that sort of generalist role, and you can have a huge, huge impact. I totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the base level of it is you're trying to earn people's trust, right? And if you can demonstrate kind of a, like you said, maybe even just a base level skill set in something that now gives you the opportunity to shine in the area you're truly interested in. Those are all kind of those stepping stones, I guess, to building an organization's trust or building even the athlete's trust around, this guy knows how to do this, so maybe I should listen to him when we're talking sprint technique or whatever it is, you know.
So let's go here first. You obviously transition from that strength role into a sort of industry role, which I think is becoming more and more common for, you know, support staff to go into. Can you almost talk us through what that decision meant to you at the time and how you look back on it?
Yeah, I think it was a very big decision for me because of how long I had spent in coaching and the amount of time. I mean, I was at a certain point in my career, I was coaching at a private facility at 5 a.m. and then I would go to a Division II university and coach the soccer team. And then I'd go to grad school and then I'd finish coaching in the hours. And so it was coaching all day, every day. So it was a little scary to kind of think, okay, well, I'm going to shelve that right now and go down this different path. But I think the thing that was important to me was that I wasn't leaving the industry. And I've always had kind of an interest in other skill sets outside of kind of traditional sports science for strength and conditioning, business development, marketing. And I felt that I had some other things to offer and that I wasn't utilizing. And so I was really interested in wearable technology, specifically kind of inertial sensor applications, and was fortunate to end up where I'm at now, just kind of a good timing. But I think the main decision why I moved over to the industry side was that I felt a little burnt out on coaching. I think I had been kind of hammering it so hard for so long that I felt a little like I wasn't giving my best sometimes to athletes kind of later on. And that just didn't really sit well with me because, you know, I've been on the other side of it and I just felt like I wasn't giving the athletes everything that I could. And so that was kind of the reason that I took a step back and said, okay, well, you know, if you want to keep going down this route, you know, what needs to change, or you can pivot and stay within kind of the greater context of serving athletes, just from a different angle.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've alluded to sort of that trust of coaches and athletes, and then you just spoke then about commitment, I guess, to their progress as athletes or as humans. I like to ask everyone that comes on the pod, what are three things that you associate with a good, I usually say sports scientist, but we can say strength coach, support staff. Are there three sort of words that you associate with someone who's good in these roles?
Yeah, I think gaining buy-in would be one. As somebody that's not in the final decision-making position of a team sport, typically the head coach is kind of making final decisions about certain variables of the sport, you're really there to service the success of the athlete and the team. And so I think service would be one, creating buy-in through service, right? Because that creates this trust with the athletes where they understand that you're there to help them and you get just as much enjoyment out of their success as they do. That's really important. And then I think the other one would just be consistency. So I've always found that athletes do really well with consistency. So, you know, if they know what their schedule looks like, if they know what you expect of them, if they know what type of testing you do every week, things along those lines, and it's consistent and not erratic, that creates kind of this machine, if you will, as a team. And that just becomes part of the status quo of how the team operates. And you see that with certain sporting organizations where they're just known as, this is how we do things. Everybody buys in. And yeah, I think that's kind of one of the underlying set of values, I guess, that a sports scientist should bring.
You mentioned that idea of being truly happy when these athletes succeed. And that's something that I see I'd like to think that I have, and I'd like to think that it's a quality that those support staff have. There is a selflessness. You're not in it to have your name up in lights, but you're truly there for the athletes to succeed. Do you think that's something that you inherently had, or you learned, or you... Take special types of people to be this way?
I think you can. So sometimes transitioning athletes will get into coaching. That doesn't always mean, just because you played a sport doesn't always mean you're going to be great at coaching it. But I think that shift from I'm no longer the athlete in this scenario to how can I help this athlete has to happen. And I can actually tell you exactly when it kind of clicked for me. I was coaching high school lacrosse and we're playing our rival team and we hit basically a buzzer beater goal to win. And I just remember looking at the head coach and I was like, I've never been that excited. Like I've personally scored buzzer beaters and I've never been that excited. And it was just the external feeling of I'm completely out of control of what's about to happen. But I feel like I've set them up for success and they just succeeded. And that's to me, it was like, okay, this is it. Like, this is what I love to do. And so I think maybe that's inherent. Maybe it's a mental switch from being an athlete, but I think you kind of have to feel that. You have to say, wow, this is just as good or better than when I was competing or when, I was going through school or whatever it is, but.
Yeah. If I was to ask you for three words that then you associate with, say, a bad sports scientist or a sports staff member, are they just the reverse, or is there something more nuanced in there in sort of how you perceive the opposite of that?
Well, I guess what helps me is to think about some of the best sports scientists I know and then think of the opposite of some of their skill sets. So I would say maybe narrow-minded. So not being able to remove yourself from kind of your inherent biases about certain things, because I think we all have systems or techniques that we feel like have been really successful for us. And so we want to kind of replicate those, right? But environment, team, personality, those all change potentially the strategy moving forward. And so if you're too tied to those things that have worked for you in the past or what you've been most successful with, I think you can lose people. And the best sports scientists I know aren't very tied to too many ideas. And if the science changes what they think, that it changes what they think and they move forward with that.
Yeah, I think especially in that sporting realm, right, where yeah, you just have to be, yeah, you have to be adaptive. You have to be flexible. I love that one. That's a really nice one.
And then I guess just, it kind of goes in line with that, but the arrogance, maybe arrogance of knowing the outcome before it happens, or thinking you know the outcome before it happens. And I think that that comes with kind of the things we talked about earlier with being service first and having some humility around your role. And yeah, being willing to admit wrongs or needs for change or needs for adaptability. And that's kind of, I guess, not too technical within the sports science field, but more about people, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a common theme that's coming through all of the discussions I've been having, that so much of what we do as support staff, as scientists, is, yes, we have that fundamental understanding of science. Yes, our job is to implement that, but the implementation of that requires all of these human communication, interaction skills, which are not the things we're taught at university. And we only learn those through those. We sort of stumble through it as we go through our internships and our first roles and make mistakes and find out the hard way that, as you said, perhaps we don't always have the answer, and perhaps there's more to it than just what the textbook told us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find it interesting that kind of crossover with sports science, that is kind of this mix of researcher and coach, right? Which there's some kind of traditional separation and maybe personality types that go into one or the other. But the sports science category really needs to be a unique merge of those two. And so that's what I find interesting about the types of people and the personalities that sometimes go into those roles.
I love that as a concept. I've never actually really thought of it that way. Can you elaborate that even further? Just because I really find that idea spot on, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, because I think, you know, and this is going to be blanket statements about,
go for it, yeah,
categories, but you know, traditionally researchers will do extremely detailed work. That's part of the role. And sometimes that work is communicated best to their own population, right? Coaches tend to have really strong, what you'd call kind of soft skills or interpersonal skills, emotional quotient, if you want to call it that. And sometimes don't kind of go super deep into the nitty gritty or the technical always. And so there's kind of this disconnect I'll see with maybe a researcher on campus and a coaching staff member, where they just don't necessarily click, and it's personality or their different parts of campus, whatever it is. But there's a lot of value that they both can bring each other. And I think that the sports scientist, as I see it, specifically at like a university level, is that kind of meld of the two that bridges that gap, and sometimes can bring those two people together, or just facilitates the information between those two.
In that tech world that you're operating in, do you see that as your job? Are you often acting as that bridge between researchers and coaches? Because I imagine you've got a lot of different spiels depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah. And I think I've gotten kind of a front row seat to it more than maybe some other technology providers, because foundationally we're a research grade tool that's used in biomechanics and engineering to measure inertial properties of humans or objects. Right. So that sits very much on kind of the research side of things. But we have this software solution that sits on the sports performance and rehab side of things, looking at lower extremity mechanical load. So there's kind of this gap that I run into a lot, specifically at universities, where the athletic program could do a lot by facilitating relationships with the labs on campus and the really skilled faculty, frankly, on campus that could provide some value. And then vice versa, the athletic staff can provide value to this faculty because there's population for data collection. So, and every researcher and every student researcher wants to collect on high level athletes. Like that's kind of the, if you look through a lot of literature, it's always general population collegiate, right? So we want to see.
You've got to add the every other grad student that's on campus as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I often get to introduce researchers on campus to athletic staff and vice versa, where the common comment I get is, oh yeah, we talked to them once and, you know, just, we didn't end up getting the athletes in there, or yeah, we talked to them once and they said that they could help us with this, but it didn't end up happening. So that's for universities, I think, that are fortunate enough to have somebody in your role. That's something that you can absolutely facilitate and probably do quite frequently. But for universities that don't, sometimes that's a role that I can help with.
That thing of we spoke once and it didn't happen. I mean, obviously it's a failing on both sides, right? When you hear those sort of conversations, they just like, you know, we chatted and we don't really like each other and we've moved on. Or is there something more just like we almost didn't see that we could benefit from each other?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it crosses all spectrums of, you know, they just didn't get along or they didn't communicate in the way that it showed mutual value. And I think that's probably the big one there, is that it can't just take from one side, and both groups are very busy. So that's another factor.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think if it's positioned in a way that shows that it actually could be a time saver and answering questions to problems that both have, then it's mutually beneficial, and it just probably needs to be communicated in that way and positioned in that way. But it's definitely, you know, it's putting a little burden on both sides to do a little extra work.
It's interesting, that idea of often it's seen as, yeah, we're already this busy, and to do this, we have to add this to it. So it just makes us more busy. And as opposed to that idea of, well, let's actually find something in this stuff we already do that we're both already trying to do, and we can both make it easier for ourselves. I think sometimes when you have that new tech, like you were saying, you always bring it into like, let's answer something new with it, rather than almost let's see what this can do to answer what's already going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. Kind of already evaluating what's already in the agenda and saying, okay, is there a crossover along this month of agenda? And if there is, then we're not adding more work to anybody's plate, but we're hopefully being more efficient with what we're trying to accomplish there.
I mean, you've spoken about trust and sort of coach language. My question is, how do you get buy-in with coaches? And I'm wondering if there's a sort of a more formal way that you have of doing that, rather than just, you know, turning up and trying to be a nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, from kind of the strength and conditioning side of things, I think I learned early on from some of those, you know, good mentorships I did have, that you set meetings with coaches to learn their process and understand, you know, what's their athletic development process. Do they have one? If they've already had one, have they been doing it for 30 years and have they been really successful with it? Because I think, like I said before, what happens to us is we've been successful with things on our own, and then we try and bring that to a group or a team. But if you don't understand the context of that coach's process, you can kind of step on people's toes and do things that maybe aren't within their normal way of doing things. So I think that's, you know, number one is creating that open line of communication relationship, stating it just like that, saying, you know, I really want this to be an open line of communication. I really want to learn from you about how you develop these athletes so that we can be cohesive and, you know, accelerate that development. And as soon as they know that, you know, you're there to support their success, and you show them that not just with your words, but you do that frequently day in, day out. I think there's that trust that starts to be built. And you know, you'll get pushback on things. I remember I had a golf program that loved Olympic weightlifting, right? They were just fascinated by it, loved it, wanted to do it. And so I would sprinkle it in kind of just because they loved it, right? And it was traditionally the golf program I worked with didn't love the weight room. So it kind of got that buy-in. And then the head coach said, no, it's going to mess up their swing. You need to stop Olympic weightlifting. It's going to cause them to elevate through their swing. You know, and that was, I could sit there and try and argue, well, you know, we're doing 3 reps of clean pulls and you guys hit 100 balls at the range. Is that really going to influence their motor pattern? Maybe, maybe not, but it's not worth me trying to argue that. I could just find something new that had similar stimulus and engage the athletes, you know, and those are kind of those battles that you choose to pick. But at the end of the day, I knew that I had that relationship that he would come and say that to me and say, I don't want you doing this and here's why. And, you know, you choose whether you want to fight that or if you can just work with them.
First off, I love the idea of setting meetings with coaches to learn about them and what they're doing, their philosophy. So often we're so busy trying to almost prove to them who we are and prove to them what we know so that they see our value in the program as opposed to just trying to learn about them. I think that's a really, really nice way to put it to start with. I think that's really nice. And then the other one, yeah, that the idea of the golf coach, and it is too easy to get so like caught up in like, you know, don't you tell me what to do? Like this, as opposed to just being, all right, look, you don't want me to do that. That's fine. I can get what I need to get out of this a different way and, you know, use my skill set to achieve it rather than just get so hung up on this one way of being and doing.
Yeah. And it really goes back to not being married to your ideas, right? Because like I personally love coaching Olympic weightlifting. It's one of my favorite things to do. So it's fun for me. I enjoy it. But I'm not married to it as a training stimulus. Like there's other ways we can accomplish that. And I think that comes with time, right? That comes with volumes of athletes working under different coaches that have different program design or just even some coaches that maybe say Olympic weightlifting's nonsense. Like, why are you even doing it? You know? So I think just exposing yourself to the gambit of training methodologies and opinions then allows you to kind of distill what you want to take with you and what you're willing to be flexible on.
Mm-hmm. When you really pull it back, it does get, you get back to that. Well, I'm here to make the athlete better. I'm here to support them in their journey and their path. This one item that we're doing is not worth either negatively affecting them or blowing up this program, because when I think about my role truly, which is helping the athlete, this little thing doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's very small.
On a side note, I do find it hilarious that people think that if you do one thing wrong, it'll ruin 100 reps of doing something right.
Yeah.
The idea, if we thought that, then why wouldn't the inverse work as well? That we could just do the right one. So that would work. But anyway, that's a skill acquisition bugbear of mine that continues to burn my brain. I'm really interested by the idea of valuing data, valuing sports science, valuing support staff. And I feel like in a business model, you have to do that. How do you go about showing that this technology or this data or this measurement is worth this amount of cash.
Yeah.
And why should this cash be spent here rather than on the bajillion other things I could spend it on?
Yeah, I think the first thing is my role as business development sales of a technology is not to convince somebody that it's the technology that they should use. I'm never going to convince someone that we have the best solution. My job is really to solve a pain point for the end user. So if, for example, we were talking about earlier, the volume of lower extremity injuries in the military. So if I know that the military has their biggest musculoskeletal injury problem is the lower extremity, and it's all from non-combat related injuries for training, my goal in those conversations is to educate the user on how we can help resolve that, and which then in turn has return for them in time, money spent on medical expenses, et cetera. And once you've kind of uncovered what that main problem is, sometimes your technology fits and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it from my perspective, from a sales perspective, it's okay to say, you know, maybe this isn't the right piece of technology for you guys, because maybe you're having, you know, upper extremity problems is your biggest problem. And I think once you kind of, this is kind of going down the sales rabbit hole, but once you get that kind of barrier of the person feeling like you're pushing something on them, and just approach it from, can we help solve a problem that is a problem you're running into consistently? Then the conversation is more about that. And it's less about, well, how much does this cost? And, you know, how often is it used? And, you know, it's less about that and more about, this is something we need to address.
And in a way that it gets back to your strength and conditioning days, right? Like you're not trying to sell lifting or strength. You're trying to understand what the coach is trying to get out of and try to understand what they see as problems. And you're trying to fix that in the weight room or the training room, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, honestly, my boss, our director of business development, Matt Clark, has straight up told me the reason he hired me was because I was the customer. So coming at it from understanding the day in and day out of their life and their work life allows me to approach it from that perspective and not, not try and sell a technology in that's going to sit on a shelf, right? It's going to solve some problems for people and they're going to be engaged with it and it's going to address something specific.
I couldn't tell you the amount of emails I get every day saying, this is a problem you have. This is our technology to fix them. Like, honestly, that's not a problem we have.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, before people are customers with us, I'm sure they maybe get annoyed from some of my outreach as well. So I can't say that I'm perfect in that realm, but I think what I do feel for is the volume of technology and, I'm sure supplements and across the gambit of different things that get pushed in front of athletic trainers and strength coaches and sports scientists. And then that's potentially one of the roles of a sports scientist is to kind of filter out that noise and say, you know, we're seeing 100 different products this year. What's actually going to bring us value? And have that return and is valid and reliable if it's a technology that's measuring something.
There's currently a whole bunch of stuff going on in the world of sleep. So measuring sleep became a really big thing. And now all of a sudden people are starting to dig into, well, how are these technologies that claim to measure sleep and sleep efficiency, how are they actually doing it? And are there things reliable? And, you know, if I take these 8 different things that measure sleep, they're giving me different numbers. And I think it's a huge space that sports science is going to, is required for these sort of teams, that you can't just take for granted that what somebody tells you is what that unit is giving you, and you can't just blindly accept that that's the truth, because it might not be.
Yeah. And that's pretty consistent from my experiences, that a lot of these pro clubs, university level organizations will do internal validations. They'll test the technology to make sure that it's giving you what you would expect or what you think it's supposed to give you, using optical motion capture or for that example, like a clinical sleep tool. Mm. You know, is it really giving us that information? And that's hard, right? Because that requires some time, and that requires the manpower internally and
expertise as well.
Expertise, exactly. So, I think there's some companies that kind of straddle in the technology space. It's interesting because there's companies that straddle the business to consumer and business to business model, right? So business to business traditionally in sports technology would be the universities, pro clubs, and the business to consumer is my mom's buying a sleep tracker.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom's expectation of a sleep tracker is very different than what a university or pro clubs should be, but sometimes the tech's the same, right? So that's I think where sometimes it can be challenging.
So you mentioned before the military space in terms of where tech or where sports science or where strength and conditioning support is now sort of being taken on at bigger and bigger amounts. Is military support sold the same way that sport support is sold?
They're different. They're definitely different, but they probably have more similarities than differences. And so one example that you're seeing is there's been, listeners may or may not know about this, but there's been an initiative, it's called H2F, and it's a holistic health and fitness initiative within the U.S. Army. And basically it's an overhaul of the Army Combat Fitness Test and the training used to prepare soldiers for this test. So the argument was, we did a bunch of research that looked at the transferability of the Army Combat Fitness Test to actual operational tasks. And they found in their research that it doesn't transfer super well. Like the typical sit up, push up, pull up, run doesn't transfer great to picking somebody up on the battlefield, lifting them up over something. And so they've made a shift. And
because we've done some work with our cadets here, when you say it like that, like the idea that sit-ups, push-ups and a 1.5 mile run is satisfactory just blows your mind, right? Sorry, I interrupted you, but it does. It's crazy.
Well, you know, and it's a product of the scale. Right. Mm-hmm. Because we know that with testing, the more athletes you have to test, the more complex the tests are, that becomes pretty massive of a workload for someone. So the origins of it is feasibility to test. And then number two was operational testing. So if I'm deployed in Iraq, can I still get my Army fitness testing in? And so that's kind of some of the underlying reasoning behind it. But they're saying, okay, well, if we're truly preparing ourselves for combat and testing, we want to do some things like a sled drag, which is more typical of what you do on the field. We want to do a deadlift. We want to do a knee tuck from a hanging position. It would be similar to kind of like lifting yourself up onto a roof. So they've made this shift, but underneath that has been a massive funding into the training facilities. So the Army's building out massive collegiate caliber training facilities and bringing in sports medicine staff, strength and conditioning staff, that are all civilians, mostly civilians, to come fill these roles. So I would not be surprised in the next 2 years if you see a lot of collegiate strength coaches shifting into tactical strength and conditioning, because these are well-paying jobs. They're pretty stable. They're in some good locations, and it's a fun population, unique with unique challenges. So I'd say it's becoming more similar. There's at the kind of tip of spear level, where we look at, you know, Navy SEAL, kind of Green Beret tier, they have access to a lot of kind of what you consider typical sports science technology, and they use it frequently. At the lower levels, that hasn't kind of fully been disseminated into the lower levels, just I think because of scope. So when I communicate to that population, we've done most of our work kind of in the elite military sector, but we're starting to kind of work down into larger cohorts. And that's probably the biggest hurdle, is just helping facilitate the scope of collection.
I honestly hadn't really thought about that as a concept, but yeah, the idea of trying to tell, you know, people stationed all across the country, you know, with relatively different setups in terms of, like you said, the equipment that they have access to, you know, when you want them all to test people on a certain day, and you've got just people who aren't necessarily trained testers there. You've just got, you know, the people who are running the units or whatever. Like, yeah, as soon as you start to layer on some complexity there, you could see the whole thing going haywire so quickly.
Yeah, and I think they've done a pretty good job of kind of putting people in leadership positions for the training and testing. But it's a pretty massive undertaking. And so it's been, you know, this started, I think, in 2018 is when they started the piloting. And it's like just now coming to fruition. So it's been a long journey to kind of make this shift. And it's interesting because, on paper, you look at it and say, oh, this is so much better. It's testing for all these more applicable training parameters. And there's pushback, right? Because there's people that don't want the change, or will argue, where are we going to get a deadlift hex bar when we're deployed? You know, all these logistical things too. So it's some growing pains, I think, but it'll be an interesting space over the next 5 years.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. You mentioned before about that idea of going back to your golf coach who didn't want Olympic lifts. If you were really, really married to that concept, what do I want to say? I almost want to say, how do you balance your sort of scientific truths with coaches who may disagree? Yeah. How do you go through that discussion of, I guess, disagreeing with a coach or wanting something different with an athlete?
Yeah. Sometimes you don't. It's just a short answer. I think for me, sometimes it's not worth trying to battle over something like that. But if it was something that I wasn't willing to compromise on, so a good example with that was we got to a point where we were doing Olympic weightlifting in the off season. And he was comfortable with it being in the off season and not during tournament season. So that was kind of a compromise, right? It was the athletes love it. We can, during season, find a similar stimulus. But if I present it to him as, well, this is why we're doing it, the athletes are buying in and they're happy to come to the weight room, maybe if we shift it to the off season, that'll be a good kind of reasoning to come to the weight room in the off season. They'll be more excited. And so that was the conversation we had, and he was like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Just as long as it's not during tournaments. So
you also alluded to your background, you know, as a lacrosse player and a footballer. Do you think that support staff or sports scientists need to know about a sport in order to contribute to it?
At the base level, I would say No. But overall, I would say yes. And the reasoning is, I think there's what we were talking about earlier, the category of sports science is very broad, and it can be very broad. And I kind of like it that way, because I think that there's a lot of areas that could use support from the sports science staff. But for example, if I'm working with a lacrosse program and I'm trying to implement a conditioning testing protocol, and I don't know the kind of work to rest ratios of the sport of lacrosse, that might cause some problems, right? That might, mm-hmm. I might test the wrong kind of conditioning protocol. And if I'm doing analysis on tactical play sets that get more goals than others, if I don't know the sport of lacrosse, I'm not going to understand the play sets. So I think at the base, you can do a lot of good without it being your primary sport or your primary understanding. But throughout that relationship, you definitely are going to want to spend some time around it and spend some time at practices and asking questions about, well, why is there only five guys on the field right now when there was a penalty? It's like, mm-hmm. well, that's a man down opportunity in lacrosse, and this is what that means, you know? So yeah, long answer to yes and no.
No, and I think that's exactly right, because I've gone through waves where at one point I was like, no, I don't have to know anything about the sport because my science is pure and I can apply these principles to anything. And then you go the opposite end. It's like, well, no, I need to know this sport intimately so that I can, as you said, really pinpoint, you know, what are the true, in my perspective, what are the true skill points that matter? What are the true techniques that are really important that'll make the difference? And then I guess, like all arguments, I settle back in the middle somewhere and be like, you know what? Yes, I can contribute on both ends. Neither is completely necessary to be effective, but I think I like where you went, that if you're going to spend time with a sport, you have to show a level of, let's not say passion, but certainly interest in, you know, inquisitiveness, you know, care, that you're going to have to learn about this sport and be engaged with this sport, you know, learn the terminologies, learn the, you know, you're going to want to watch all the pro stuff so that you can speak the language of the athletes and your coaches you work with, because if you don't, you'll quickly make yourself an outsider and just sort of people will see you don't care. I think that's probably what it gets down to, right?
Yeah, and at the end, it's more fun to watch a sport you understand, right? And at the end of the day, you know, if you're a strength coach, athletic trainer, like you do a lot of watching of the sport, you know. And so if you understand it, the ins and outs, you buy in more, just like we talked about earlier. So I think, yeah, and it's difficult. I feel for somebody that comes in and has 20 sports that they're potentially going to work with, right? But it can happen over time.
Yeah, the idea of not engaging with a sport if you're going to get stuck watching it for 9 hours or 4 days or whatever. Yeah, you'd want to quickly find something you find interesting about that sport. Otherwise, I don't think it'd be long for it.
Yeah, it's like being at a track meet all weekend or something. You know, they're long and they last all day.
Yeah, I've done a lot of sports in my career, and I think the common thread is that once you sort of understand the nuances of the sport, I find them more and more interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like a sport that's kind of – I'm a huge fan of is mixed martial arts, and that's a classic sport that if you watch it with people that maybe don't understand jiu-jitsu or don't understand grappling, they're just like, what are we watching? This is mm-hmm. – really, really boring, or it's not skilled enough. And then as soon as you kind of take a deep dive into it and start understanding the techniques, it becomes fascinating because it's just these amazing athletes with such broad skill sets. And, you know, I could just watch it all weekend.
It's the same with any sport, right? You think about the pitcher, you know, at the base level, you're just watching some guy throw it and some guy try to hit it. And then as you get into it, you realize all the nuances of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to get the other person to do, all those one-on-one sort of contests going on continually, which just reel me in for sure.
Yeah, cricket's one that I've been starting to watch a bit because of my Australian New Zealand counterparts.
Wow,
down in that
office. Now we're talking.
Yeah. Fortunately, you can catch some on like ESPN Plus. They'll have it on weekends every now and then.
I hear Aussie Rules there's an Aussie Rules competition about to start here in Memphis, and so that's the next great bridge. All righty, Blake, this has been, everything I could have hoped for. Is there anything that we've missed that you want to sort of discuss, share your strong thoughts with the world?
I guess just from the advice side of things, I think sometimes in this industry or category, we can, early on in our career, we can get tied up with the level of athletes we're working with. So I want to work at the NBA. I want to work at the University of Memphis Division I football. And so just kind of reflecting on, is that important to you? Because I think at the end of the day, you should really be happy whatever level you're at, whether it's your local high school or it's at that NBA level. Because it is that you should get that joy out of the service first approach. And if that's, all those boxes are ticked, then I think you're in the right industry. And, then I guess just knowing how broad the industry is and applications is pretty exciting, at least in my view, because there's kind of this never ending journey that you can go down in different skill sets. And so, like talking to you, like I can learn a lot about skill acquisition and motor control and learning. I worked at a private high school for about 3.5 years as their head strength coach. And I learned a lot about the pedagogy of philosophy of the school. And that had a lot of influence on the way I tried to teach my athletes, because at the end of the day, you're teaching. I think kind of having that open mindset about the continuous learning that can happen in the field will really set you up for success in the field or a diversion like I took into kind of the commercial side.
The way you speak about that makes me almost think that, I don't know if it's that you saw yourself as more than a strength coach, but I think you saw, is it safe to say that maybe you saw that there's more to strength coaching than just the strength part of it? Is that fair?
Yeah. I think I saw it as teaching. And then when you start to think of it as teaching, then it becomes, you can teach a lot of things, right? That was just happened to be my educational skill set. But if I wanted to, I could take teaching in a different route and I could have worked. Maybe I could have worked at that private high school and got into teaching credential. And then there's opportunities at the university level as well to be adjunct faculty and work with athletics as well. So, I think for me, it was about getting better at communicating the message that I was teaching.
Yeah, I really like that. And realizing that there's, wherever you are, there's going to be opportunities to learn. You've got to be aware of the fact that you're trying to learn in, there's spaces for you to grow in multiple areas rather than just that narrow silo.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, a question I could ask you back is if there was an area in sports science that you feel like is an area you want to grow in or have grown the most in, where would that be? And I guess just since you've been at Memphis.
Ooh, since I've been at Memphis, the biggest thing I've been challenged with is trying to affect more than just the athletes that I work directly with or more than just the coaches I work directly with. Trying to view my role from like a from a return on investment point of view, like you were talking about earlier, that idea that if I affect just one coach and a small segment of athletes, it's a lot harder to justify a salary than if I can positively affect a large number. But the challenge as I see it is that traditionally I have a much better impact when I work closely with someone. And like you're saying, you build those relationships, you can have those discussions, you can sort of ebb and flow those things. You're not in a rush to like make something happen. And so there's been a real sort of reckoning almost within myself of that. Can you create a process to what you do so that you can roll this out sort of wider, or is there some lessons that you can share without necessarily that real intimate change?
And that's probably the director level, right? Where there needs to be some delineation of responsibilities to other people to then act out that vision for the program, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's hard, right? Like you know, as you go up the ranks, you're trying to justify the impact that you have on athletes and coaches. And in my previous roles, I've only ever been asked to, well, just, you know, you're good at this, go do what you do, work with these athletes and coaches. And we'll decide if you're successful if that coach says, yeah, he was good, or that athlete says, I hate that guy, I don't want him ever near me again. And so that was basically the barrier to success. Are you in or are you out with the team you've been charged with? Whereas now almost seeing it from a different view, it's almost like, well, yeah, is our nutrition program having the positive effects on our athlete nutrition that we want it to? And so trying to assess things like, well, it's costing this much. This is the change in both, you know, knowledge in, you know, fat mass, you know, muscle mass of our athletes, you know, trying to attribute stuff to interventions has been a challenge and something that's been, I think, really needed in terms of the way I view sport and sport science. I think it gets away from a bit from that sort of almost mystique of especially skill acquisition to actually sort of proving realness. I don't know. Proving impact. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah. I was talking to an NBA sports scientist recently that had just been recently promoted to kind of director level, let's say. And they were discussing the challenge of the transition for them because they were so used to being in the trenches and collecting data and building all these reports. And now they were kind of managing those people. So there was kind of this shift in the way they had to look at things globally, as opposed to kind of focused in on their specific tasks.
You know? Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, like I think you said it earlier, like, you know, we're good sports scientists or good sports, the good people in sport are naturally inquisitive. They're naturally always looking to learn. They're not too stuck in their ways and they're constantly reevaluating the way they think and the way they operate. And I think if you do want to either shift jobs or shift careers or, you know, shift positions, you do need to have that open mind and that almost that want to learn and want to be better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, have you got any final words of advice for our young sports scientist out there?
No, I think I've given him all the advice I can give. I think the primary thing just to keep coming back to is you really have to enjoy the day in and day out. Mm-hmm. And the status really shouldn't matter. It's about the improvement of outcomes of your athletes and your coaching staffs and helping facilitate that. And you can do that in a lot of ways. I still feel like I get to do that externally, kind of from a team.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I guess just on that note, there's a lot of careers out there in sports science and it's growing. Apparel brands, footwear brands, nutrition brands, wearable technology, connected fitness, is a new massive space that I think young sports scientists should look into. So there's a lot of ways you can take the career, which is exciting time for the field. So that would be kind of my final words, and I appreciate you having me, Daniel.
I appreciate you, Blake. Thanks again so much. Yeah, great to have you on board, and yeah, cheers, buddy.
Thanks.
That was the sixth episode of the Applying Sports Science podcast. Huge thanks to Blake for his honesty, time, and experience sharing his realities, nuances, and unwritten rules of applying science to sport. Proudly brought to you by the Human Performance Center as part of the College of Health Sciences at the University of Memphis. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Keep up to date with the Human Performance Center on Twitter and help us keep evolving that relationship between science and sport.